Hello, TSF family. We wanted to start off by saying thank you. Thank you for listening to this podcast and for your hard work to love yourself more and for your feedback.
Can you believe it's been 3 years that we've been doing this spiritual fix, and it has been such a beautiful labor of love for Anna and me.
We have loved doing this work. We've loved hearing from you, and we love exploring ourselves and each other alongside our listeners.
We wanted to put out the call for 3 ways that you can help support us to support you.
One, we would love you to leave us a review on iTunes or follow us on Spotify.
2, drop us an email and let us know how much the podcast means to you.
And 3, you can donate monthly or even just once to our PayPal patronage.
Every little bit helps, and we are so grateful to those of you who have donated already. Thank you.
You help make this podcast possible.
Thanks, y'all.
You can go to our website, www.thisspiritualfix.com, for information on how to pledge as well as to email us. Hello, TSF family. This is episode 20 of season 6. Today, we are talking about the sibling wound. This is an incredible episode packed full of information. Enjoy.
Hypnosis. Mindfulness. Meditation. Past life regression.
Mommy, can you say?
This spiritual fix. Two mystical mamas hacking the self-help game.
With Anna Stromquist
and Christina Wiltsey.
Hey, Christina.
Hi, Anna.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm enjoying this lovely fall where all the leaves are still on the trees, but it's not hot anymore, which is like incredible.
I'm loving that it's not hot and that I don't have to time my day, like when I can go outside kind of thing.
Yes.
But I don't like that my plants are starting to die. Like my tomato plants, my cucumber plants, the hydrangeas are no longer producing flowers. It's just, it's kind of like a sad time for me, but I'm getting over it by harvesting seeds for next year. So that's how I'm like, well, I can go pick some seeds. So yeah. Lots of seed picking. And just so you know, if you have zinnia or dahlia or, you know, cosmos or marigolds, if you just have those flowers once, you never have to buy seeds again. I'll put in the show notes a YouTube video of how to just pull seeds out of dead flowers. It's so simple and it's changed my life.
Yeah. It's a really, I think that's, I love it. It's like my favorite part of gardening is recognizing the abundance of the fact that when you want to bring a new intelligence into your property, so a new flower, you have to buy and bring that intelligence from outside because, you know, and obviously checking to see if that intelligence works with your property is good. Like for instance, if I were to plant kiwi fruit here, I would get as much kiwi fruit growing on all the vines of my property, like if, especially after we leave, if, you know, and it would become invasive because it would just take over the environment. Right. But, you know, when you bring a new intelligence in, that's when you need to buy it. But otherwise the intelligence is already on your property. Just propagate it.
I know. Like I have Jerusalem artichoke and I planted 5 last year and then I forgot to dig them up and eat them. And this year I have like 15 to 20 because of that. So I'm like, oh yeah, this is Jerusalem artichoke. I forgot about you. And you've multiplied on your own and everything multiplies. And I started taking dead flowers to my patients' houses and showing them how to pull off the petals and find the seeds because they had never done it, but they love it. And I'm like, this is all you do. And they're like, life-changing.
It's so amazing. Yeah. Sunchokes, our Jerusalem artichokes in general are incredibly prolific.
Oh my goodness.
And native. Yeah. They're actually native, but, and it's funny because the
Georgia.
Native to Georgia. Thank you. Yes. The deer love them, but they're so prolific that it's kind of okay. Like, I don't know, has the deer gotten yours?
So I planted mine along the air conditioning units and they make a lot of noise. And I think it scares the deer because they have not eaten them.
Yeah. Yeah.
But anyways, that was not what this episode was going to be about. Today, we got a lot of great feedback on the sibling episode. A lot of parents, especially who have children, they loved it. And we heard from a few people that they wanted us to do an episode on the sibling wound. And then that's what this episode's about. And just before we begin the episode, we always do a little prelude where we talk about another topic. Before we go into that, I just want to mention that I feel like I'm doing this episode for the second time because I had all this anxiety about the episode because I could not find any books. It was very little material out there on the sibling wound. And I was stressing about it because I was like, we're going to prepare an episode and I can't find any resources. And I went to bed and I prayed to Archangel Michael to show me what the episode should be about. And I basically recorded this episode in my dream already. And in the dream, I was revealed what we will talk about today. And it was shown to me that the sibling wound is no different than any other relationship wound. And if we can approach it like we would approach any relationship that has been damaged, although this one just has a lot more history to it, then we can heal it. So that was the essence of the dream. And then we'll get into everything else. But first, in this prelude, we want to talk a little bit about iPhone apps. Christina, do you want to start or should I?
You go ahead.
Okay. So I use my phone for a lot of things. And I've come to recognize it's great for people who have limited short-term memory, which is me. And it keeps my life organized. And I have two favorite apps. So I just wanted to talk about them. I got them both in the last few months and I really love them. So the first one is called Me, and it's a calendar app for people with ADHD. And it's more like a list than a calendar, although you can do it like a calendar. And I was very adverse to doing digital calendars before because that's just not how my brain works. I have to write everything down. But the way that this app is formulated, I can make it like a list. I can color code them. I can put icons on them too. And when I complete a task, I get a dopamine hit from the app. And then when I complete everything on my list, it throws confetti, which is so silly, but that is enough to change my whole world. And I have been extremely on top of things, extremely productive. I love this app. And I don't know, it had great reviews. It was for ADHD people. I had to pay for it. And I was like, I can't believe I'm paying for an app in this day and age. But I'm so glad I did because it's really, really helpful for my brain. So there was that.
That's awesome.
Okay. Then the second app I did is called Pearls. And Pearls is really cool because it's kind of like Duolingo where you get a streak and it'll like remind you, you haven't hit your streak today and this and that. But what Pearls is an app that every morning or whenever you want, you check mark off your interests like self-help or environmentalism or productivity or whatever. And then it'll give you books, one book a day. You can do more if you want. And basically it's a 15-minute synopsis of the book, it's an audio synopsis, 15 minutes, 20 minutes max. I listen to it 1.25 speed. So it's done very quickly. And then a little written synopsis if you're visual. And I love it because I'm getting to read a new book every day. And it's their topics. Like one was about Navy SEALs and leadership. And like one I listened to today was called What Doesn't Kill Us, about the need to really challenge our body on a physical level. And every day I just get a new book and I'm loving it because I'm learning about new things. But here's the funny part. I did the free trial and then I canceled it. And when I canceled it, the membership suddenly was 57% off. So just so you know, if you try it out, when you cancel, it'll push forward a discount for the app for the year. So anyways, those are the two apps I'm enjoying a lot. And then a third thing I'm enjoying, which is actually not an app, is no electronics at all. So my friend Michelle and I went river rafting for our birthdays and we had to leave our phones in the car and we went a whole day without the phone. And I've done that a few times, especially in Vipassana retreats where you leave your phone in the car for a 1 day retreat or for whole 10 days if you're doing the 10 day retreat. And I love it. I always love the break. But when we were done with the river rafting, we were like, you know, what was really extra good about today was that one, we didn't die. And we found out when the rafting was over, just how many people die in that river. And wow. I'm so glad I didn't know beforehand because I never would have done it.
Yeah.
They were like level 4 and 5 rapids, which was really stupid of us. But the second thing was that we were like, we love that we were off our phones all day. So one of the books that I listened to was called Limitless by Jim Kwik. K-W-I-K, he says that one of the limitations we put on ourselves is actually like the structure of our brain and the habits that we get into. And one of those such things is the phone, which we become very reliant on to be our memory bank, to be our calendar, and to be our dopamine go-getter. And just taking a break from the phone is really good from brain health. So anyways, I did it. I did it from sundown to sundown, Friday to Saturday, because I was like, it's Shabbat. We're going to work out today anyways. I always make a big dinner Friday night and we just eat leftovers on Saturday anyways. So it just kind of fit into the whole resting vibe. Did it. I loved it. I got so much done, although that's not the point of Shabbat. But the point for me was just to take a break from, you know, yeah, being attached to the phone.
Yeah.
And it was lovely. Like, I just loved it. And I definitely want to keep doing this every week. And just in that one little 24-hour period of not having my phone on me, I realized I can go further without it. I feel like I'm breaking that addiction. It's really nice. Anyways.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. And it totally relates to exactly what I was going to say regarding apps in general, whether it's Android or iPhone or anything like that, is that I went on my anniversary trip with my husband over these last couple of days, and I happened to pick up this really amazing book. There were like a couple of books on Japanese culture, and I am a bit of a Nihonphile. Like, I really like Japanese culture. I won't even get into that. But basically, it was a book on yokai culture, which is interesting because it's about like the super normal, like if you've ever seen the like demon pictures and stuff like that. And it's like gaining a lot of resurgence now. Like, people are really interested in this culture, even though it was like kind of a very small subset of Japanese culture. But the crazy thing was that in this book, at the end of it, there was this chapter that was about boundaries. And the guy explained boundaries from a Japanese perspective, to the fact where boundaries are humongous in Japanese culture, right? A friend of mine recently spent a month in Japan and was like, people in Japan are really good at entryways, right? Because an entryway is a boundary. It's like, it's a transition space. It's a space in which, you know, things need to happen. And they're incredibly good at the design of this. And the way that boundary theory in Japan, one view of boundary theory.
Oh, you mean like home decor? Sorry. What did you mean by that?
I mean like architecture, but also everything. Like, everything for them is about, like, they're constantly understanding boundary, and I'll explain why. One of the views of boundary theory is that in Western culture, we view boundaries as a fence. It's a two-dimensional line that we maybe create between us and another person. In Japanese culture, in this boundary theory, they understand that boundaries has a dimension in and of itself. It's a periphery, right? It's anything that sits on the periphery. And it's a space where there are clashing views, there are clashing opinions, like everything is kind of in opposition, you know, like it's a chaotic space, because it's like anything, like we have centers and we have peripheries in our lives. And the periphery is the boundary between us and another thing. So one of the examples is Western culture views boundaries as like a piece of paper. Like, we're on the front, and anything that we don't agree with or anything that we don't want in our life is on the back of the piece of paper. And, you know, the four edges of the piece of paper are so thin, nothing can sit there. But in Japan, there's depth to the sides of the paper, right? And there's a recognition that there's this space of things that are still in our field, but we're not getting attention to them all the time, or they're kind of sitting in these other spaces, right? So yokai culture, the supernormal stuff that, you know, paranormal stuff that's associated with Japan, sits on the periphery. It's like, it's a boundary zone between all of these different dimensions and all of these different possibilities, right? And because people's attention isn't on it all the time, it can kind of become anything. And so how that relates to iPhone is that I started to notice that I actually created a design of apps on my phone that tried to mimic that same idea, right? I have, you know, on iPhones in particular, you can create folders. And a lot of people just do this anyway, because they just want to be really organized. But for me, I have the things that I want in my center, which like feed me a lot and like feed me in really wonderful ways. I want them to not be in a folder and I can see them. I can see them all, right? And I can just like click on them. So like Duolingo, learning Japanese, of course, and, you know, my notes app and a couple of different things that like are central to feeding me as a person in the kind of center of my life. And then everything that sits on the periphery that I don't want to access as much, I put inside of folders. And what I started to recognize was that when I get into periods where I'm on my phone too much, the periphery becomes really, really big, right? Like I'm like having to go inside a folder, inside a folder, inside a folder in order to get to like a game to play all the time. And then sometimes I just bypass that system. So for me, I'm working right now on recentering and like figuring out and actually really trying to uphold what feeds my center and keep the things on the periphery in the periphery, in the sense of like not spending 2 hours on something that's in my periphery, like a game, right? You know what I mean? Or something like that, you know, or, you know, I love my remote viewing app that we've talked about in the past, you know, that's like a 5 minute thing, right? You know, it's like, it's a really quick thing, but it's something that sits on the periphery. It helps me understand the periphery of all of life, which is that kind of other abilities and different things like that, but that what the things that are in my center is the most important thing, which includes, I'm also incorporating, and it was funny because this happened at the same time, Anna, that like right when you decided to have your app-free day, Luke and I were reframing our lives a little bit about like what the things that we want to center in our life. And like, we're now doing that for our family for all of Saturday. We're asking everybody to go off of any device whatsoever. So Luke and I are doing it. The kids are doing it. Everybody's doing it. And then we usually will watch a movie at night. We've kind of started to do that, but my kids, they wanted it. They got like grounded once and they weren't allowed to be on any device. And at the end of the day, they're like, this is the best day ever.
It's so cute. My kids used to do that in the summer. They'd be like, we're going to go completely technology free and eat all our food outside. And like, they had this whole thing about how long could they stay outside?
Yeah.
It was so cute. Well, I want my husband to do it with me next week. I'm going to propose it to my husband next week to join me in our modified Shomer Shabbos thing with the no phone. And then with my kids, I'm going to like wait and see if they want to do it without me asking just yet, because unlike your kids, and I would probably do it if my kids were homeschooled, but your kids have the ability to get on technology all day because they're at home all day. My kids are at school all day. They have activities after school. They have activities before school. Like our schedule is so crazy busy. So the weekend is really their only time to rot their brain. So well, on to the episode. I'm really excited about this episode because I feel like it's really helpful. It was given to me in a dream. So I feel like it's got to be special for that reason. And I just want to thank Archangel Michael for the dream, because I think it's going to be useful for us and for the listeners. But to just recap, I had frustration with not finding a specific book on healing sibling wounds. And then the dream showed me that we need to approach the sibling wound like we would approach any relationship in need of repair. And so I was told that the best thing we should do is to talk about 5 major areas in which we can repair relationships. And a lot of the stuff we're going to talk about today are things we've discussed in previous episodes. And so I will link those episodes in the show notes to go back to and listen to more detail on that topic. But basically, Chris and I are going to talk about 5 major ways to repair relationships in a specific order. But beforehand, what I was shown in the dream was that we need to first identify what level is your broken relationship, or we should say, I don't know if broken relationship is the right term.
Disharmonious. Yeah.
We need to look at the relationship in terms of levels. So we have level 1 up to level 5. And it's really important when you're looking at this scale is to recognize that it's not just about how much disharmony is in the relationship. It's about how much honesty is in the relationship. So I was shown in the dream how Christina and I, as well as my husband and I, have a very, very honest relationship where, you know, if Christina does something that hurts me, I let her know immediately and hopefully vice versa. I hope you feel like you can come to me when I hurt you too.
Yeah.
And same with my husband. Like it could be something little, like, you know, but why did, you know, that bothered me that you did X, Y, and Z. And so if you have harmony in a relationship because you're being dishonest, you need to calculate that in your percentages here, because in a relationship where someone does something that hurts you or bothers you and you don't feel the safety net to bring it up, that is disharmony. You're having harmony at the expense of your own feelings. Okay. You are swallowing your needs at the expense of the relationship. And you need to take that into consideration, like how much honesty is actually happening here And then how much disharmony is happening? Because I can definitely say, oh, I have a very harmonious relationship with so-and-so, but so-and-so doesn't know that I'm really annoyed that they never pay me back when we go out to eat or something, right? Yeah, like exactly. There's like that kind of thing, right? Okay. So the levels are disharmony, 0 to 20% is level one. Level two is disharmony 20 to 40% of the time. Level three is 40 to 60% of the time. Level four is 60 to 80% of the time. And level five is 80 to 100% of the time. So what I like about this is that even in the most harmonious relationships, there will be disharmony up to 20% of the time, you know, which I kind of like that there's like this wiggle room of like, we have a great relationship. I have a great marriage, this and that. And yet, you know, between 0 to 20% of the time, well, there's some disharmony and that's okay. And that's normal. And like Archangel Michael is still calling that a level one relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really important to recognize too. And that is that like disharmony helps us understand that in the cultivation of a relationship, you don't cultivate relationships to have 0%. That's like not literally not the reason that probably we create relationships. I genuinely don't think so.
Right. Like, exactly.
I create a relationships recognizing that my partner, I do now. I probably didn't before. I probably did it for anxious or avoidant reasons before, but now I would say that I stay in my relationship and cultivate it because of the fact that I can have disharmony in myself. They can maybe sometimes be a projection of that disharmony, but they're going to still be okay with that because ultimately disharmony I'm feeling in the relationship is probably a level of disharmony I'm having with myself. And so if they're willing to be there with me on that playing field and they're willing to grow with me as a result of that, then that's what I want in a relationship.
Exactly. And you know, you are completely transparent with Luke. And so that is also a really good number, right? A really good percentage, if you think about it in terms of the disharmony. And, you know, so we idolize people who say, oh, me and my spouse never argue. We never go to bed angry. It's okay. 0 to 20% disharmony. It's okay. And, you know, it's funny because my stepdaughter said that her boss, who's like this very ingenious designer in Atlanta, says, if you just get 80% of what you want in life, you're doing damn good. You know, like 80% of what you want is a really high number. Like sometimes we think our partner needs to be perfect. Like I have a friend and I love her so much and she's on all these dating apps. And then it's like watching an episode of Seinfeld because she'll always come back finding some fatal flaw in the guy. And I'm like, but he's got 80% good going for him. Can't you see past the fact that he's not like adamant about this one political view or whatever? It's cute. But anyways, 80% of the time is great.
I also, can I just like really emphasize that I feel like you could probably extend what you just said in the calculation of harmony versus honesty as like people pleasers, right? This is what comes to mind is like people pleasers and people who are in placating relationships, right? Where like they're constantly being placated, like that whole happy wife, happy life. People, like if there are, you know, anybody in the relationship who's willing to just say, as long as I keep you happy and you stay off my back, that's all I really care about, right? That like, that's the genuine people pleaser is like, they are willing to completely sacrifice their own integrity and their own honesty for the sake of harmony. And see if you can assess that in all of your relationships. How much does that happen in all of your relationships, right?
Yeah. That Netflix show, Ted Can Get Effed. Have you seen the thing? It's like totally about that. It's like a sitcom where Allison, she hates her husband, Ted, but she always goes along with him and they have the laugh track. And then as soon as he leaves the room, it's like this dark drama.
I love it. Oh my God. I love the mixture of genres like that. Yeah, it's incredible.
It's really well done. So anyways, that reminds me of that. So regarding these levels, right? Level one through five, you can help. You can use this scale to kind of identify where is your relationship with your sibling? Is it at a level five? Like you just can't even stand to be in the room with them for a second. Or is it a level one where you disagree, you know, a few times a year or have some upset? Well, maybe the relationship doesn't need any repair, right? But here's what I thought was great about the dream. When you look at this scale and you look at level five and level down 4, 3, 2, 1, if you're got a level five relationship and you're praying for a level one, you need to be realistic. And this is funny because growing up, I had probably a level 5 relationship with my sister. We are now best friends. We are now level 1. She is absolutely one of my favorite people and my biggest cheerleaders and supporters. But for a lot of my childhood, we had a level 5 relationship, meaning very disharmonious, pulling each other's triggers left and right. And I always wanted a level 1. And I was very jealous of level 1. But over the course of life, we moved from a 5 to a 4, to a 3, to a 2, to a 1. And so I want you to think about setting a realistic expectation today that if you have a level 5 or a level 4 harmonious relationship with a sibling, your goal, although it might ultimately be a level 1, a realistic goal for you now in your life is just dropping down one level. Okay. Just move from level 5 to level 4. Bravo. Okay. Then when you're in a level 4, move from a 4 to a 3. But for now, be realistic. If you can move from a 5 to a 4, just that in itself is awesome. Let's set some realistic expectations because relationships are two-sided and your sibling might be very happy to be in the situation they are in because maybe the dynamic is feeding them in some level that we don't understand. You know, they're getting something out of the disharmonious relationship, but just kind of prepare yourself that jumping from a 5 to a 1 might not be in the cards for you this year, this month, this lifetime, but getting from a 5 to 4 is realistic probably. And that's what we're going to try to work on today, like how you can just jump down one level.
Right. And I think there's a really necessary thing in here because I know I've definitely heard and worked with people a lot who are dealing with siblings who are meant to be in a 5 and stay in a 5. Right. I think that that's a really necessary thing to point out here is that it's dangerous, right? There's abusive siblings. There are people who, like you said, like there's something in the disharmony or the dynamic, the power dynamic that's happening, in which case they have absolutely no desire to move or change. And whenever you are around them, you know, there's a level of disharmony that you feel just in the need to protect yourself. And that sometimes that will happen. Sometimes, you know, there's also an assessment in here, which says, do I want to change from being a level 5 to a level 4? Or if I don't, can I be decisive about how I do that? How I, mm-hmm. you know, how I no longer have this person. I mean, I would argue to say that if you are a level 5 and you actually honestly ask yourself, am I interested in being a level 4? And you don't, then why is this person still around in your life? Like, why are you allowing this level of disharmony to persist? And what you can do in those situations is if that person's not interested in moving, then you can decide that you can create a level in harmony of harmony inside of yourself and kind of repair the things that they've done to you inside of yourself, which we'll talk mm-hmm. about, I'm sure, but like to move yourself down to a level 1 with regards to thinking about them, not that you're necessarily forgiving them or anything like that, but they just are in your periphery. They're outside, they're in a boundary zone. They are just super outside right. of your periphery and you have harmony on a day-to-day level and they are not infringing on your daily peace.
Exactly. And then just to give some common sense reasons why a level 5 might be safe, just to go over, it would be say history of sexual assaults, history of domestic violence, history of abusing children. You yourself have children, financial abuse, untreated alcoholism, untreated drug addiction. Now, if they have a history of that and they have gotten sober, that's a totally different story. But we're talking about active abusers. These are all totally justifiable reasons to not want to engage or have your children exposed to that sibling, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so moving forward, we're going to talk about the 5 major ways that we can repair the relationship. And this can be said of probably any relationship, I think. But the first one we're going to talk about is Ho'oponopono, which are forgiveness exercises that you can do on your own without interacting with a sibling. Number 2, we're going to talk about mental exercises such as feeding your demon and family constellation that you can do in your mental field. The 3rd one we're going to talk about is the 360-degree life review, which does not happen to us until we die, but there are ways to bypass that and jump into it now while we're alive, and we'll talk about that soon. The 4th is conversation. This is when you actually step into having a conversation with the sibling. And number five is mediation when necessary. So those are the five topics we're going to go for it today. So, all right. So I'm going to talk a little bit about Ho'oponopono now. And we have a whole episode about this. I'm going to link it in the show notes. So this is basically when you say, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I love you. Thank you. And what you are saying is that you believe on some level that we are all connected and that everything that exists in your life is there to ultimately serve you. And that everything that exists in your life is there because you are co-creator of it. Now, even if you don't believe that fundamentally, if you just entertain the idea that your sibling has a role in your brain, your sibling occupies a character space in your brain that you have created. No one else sees your sibling the same way you see them. Their spouse doesn't see them like that. Their child doesn't. Their lover doesn't. Your parents might not. You have created in your mind a character version of your sibling, which may or not be true about who they are. And so in that sense, you know, we only interact with the part of them that we ourselves perceive. So on some level, when you're saying, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I love you, thank you, I am a co-creator of the world in which you exist, we are recognizing that our perception of them is something that we have co-created. Okay. There are plenty of people who are demonic and their spouses just think they hung the moon, right? And then there are people who are not even that terrible parents or terrible siblings and people think they're the ultimate villain. So we are co-creators of how we are perceiving these people. So when you say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I love you, thank you, you're saying, I am so sorry that I have created a reality in which we have a disharmonious relationship. I am so sorry that I have co-created you as a character villain in my story, or I am so sorry that we are not close. Please forgive me means please forgive the role that, and you say this to them, you know, in your mind, please forgive me for the role that I have in co-creating a disharmonious relationship. Please forgive me to myself. I'm sorry to myself that I have co-created a relationship of disharmony when there's other possibilities out there. I love you means beyond all the shit that I see in you, all our history, all our bullshit, I do love you. And ultimately, I love your soul, right? Thank you means thank you for this whole experience. Thank you for being in my life. Thank you for playing the villain in my story. Thank you for whatever trauma or pain you've caused me. It has helped me become who I am. And you can just say, I'm sorry, please forgive me, I love you, thank you, over and over and over again, saying different things as you do it. You can even look at a photo of them and just say it. You want to implement Ho'oponopono on you, on the sibling, and maybe all the other characters involved in the story, maybe parents, maybe grandparents, maybe other siblings, all help facilitate the situation of disharmony. So that's the first step.
Yes. And I want to add to it a little bit, because I think these first two steps in particular, imagine that you have like a bowl of ramen, right? And there are all sorts of things in your ramen that kind of affect your daily life all the time. And I feel like Ho'oponopono is one of the best examples of recognizing that there might be something in your bowl that you don't necessarily want, but that at some point it got put in there for one reason or another. And you're kind of like, I'm just going to kind of accept that this is the case. Because ultimately what we see with siblings is that in The Celestine Prophecy, which is a book that I've mentioned in the past, in a past episode, we can put that in the show notes, the link to it, is that all of siblings, whether they are adopted or biological or anything like this, we recognize that according to The Celestine Prophecy, everybody is a combination of their parents' two kind of motives in life. And they're bringing their parents' motives and kind of purposes in life and bringing it into a new fruition they're furthering it, they're evolving it. And you start to recognize that if you have five siblings, all of them are going to be a combination of parents and what those parents are to be able to like, and yet everybody is interpreting it differently. Right? Everyone is interpreting this experience completely differently. And so what we recognize is that fundamentally, they're all different manifestations, it's like imagine having a packet of seeds and you're just spreading it out. It's like they're all wildflowers, but they're all going to show up as different flowers. They're all going to show up as different experiences. And I think that a lot of us think that because of blood principles, like all the principles were raised on the same principles, and therefore all our principles should be the same. And what's going to differ is opinions. But the more that we grow away from that original place, we start to recognize that the principles, opinions become principles very often and within our lives. If we feel strongly enough about something, it starts to become a principle, right? And we start to recognize that our varying principles are like having to, you know, you get together at Christmas and all of a sudden you're just like, oh my God, how does this person have a completely different principle than anything else? Maybe they never even got influenced by the parents. Maybe they came into this life with a certain principle. And so the idea with Ho'oponopono that I appreciate is the recognition that there can be differences, that there can be inherent differences between your siblings, and that you don't necessarily need to be united in the sameness. You're not supposed to be the same. And so recognizing and doing Ho'oponopono in order to recognize those differences, recognize your role in holding up a projection of a person and co-creating the view of that person and how they interact with the family is contributing to it. And also giving a lot of allowance for the fact that people change and people are very different. Everybody's coming into a different manifestation of this, for instance, you know, combination of your two parents' purposes, and being able to allow people to do that without having to be the same or without having to be similar or have similar views and opinions is really important. And being able to release them of that is what Ho'oponopono does.
I want to just piggyback on there. Very similarly are the primal wounds. You know, if you go back and listen to those 5 episodes, your siblings may have come here with totally different primal wounds than you. So the same situation is going to provoke different things in them. So my mother died, and for me, I perceived it as abandonment. And for another sibling, you know, they felt betrayed by life. Another one felt like it was an extreme injustice. Another one felt rejected. So it's like the same events are going to trigger different responses in your siblings than they are with you. And then their mask is going to correspond to that wound. And so a lot of their behaviors and such are coming from the different wound, but even though you had the same life experience, and then maybe you didn't, maybe there was favoritism. So there's all that too. Okay. We'll get into that with the life review.
Okay. So the next thing is feed your demon. Whereas Ho'oponopono, like Anna said, it's more of an emotional, it's more of a heart-centered thing. And it's more of an acceptance of your role in the projection of a person and trying to resolve that projection and allow someone to just be whoever they are and however different they are. Feeding your demon is a mental process, but I think that what's really, really important about it before I kind of describe it is the recognition of the fact that, like, you may have demons as associated, and we say demons, it's basically, you can say it's huge pockets of resistance that have formed and almost feel like they have a life of their own. The way that I see demons at this point is that it's like so much energy has been put into this thing that we associate as other, that it usually has a voice and it usually has a life of its own. It's causing spirals inside of your mind. It's causing, you know, whenever you have arguments with somebody, like if you've ever, I've been in this situation with my sibling, and everybody on the podcast who's heard it knows kind of the history of this, is that, you know, I used to have, and this happened with Anna, even, I think I described it in that episode too, is where I would have arguments in my head with the person, but ultimately I was having arguments, not with that person, but with a demon projection representation of that person. Right. And it was feeding something in me when I was having those arguments inside of my head. And so to me, the feed your demon is the way to disarm that demon, to be able to recognize, it's one method of disarming that demon, of being able to say, like, hey, this is nothing to do with the other person. This has everything to do with me clearing the projections, and especially the projections that have literally taken on a life of their own and can have arguments with me in my head. This is my way to disarm that.
I just had this epiphany of, like, you know, that very biblical saying that you should have no false idols. It's kind of making me think, wonder like if that. It's talking about, like, our false perception of people, like our demonic twists on them.
I genuinely, the inner villain work, I did the inner villain circle last year, and I'm kind of still developing it to kind of come into its next iteration. But I think that the villains are just versions of demons that are false idols. We're basically creating an entire universe. Like when it gets really bad, we have a ruler who is a sibling who treated us in a very particular way. It starts off as these thoughts of having the argument, and it starts off as a demon or a false idol. And then we create this entire world of our behavior and everything in our life around this person, right? Around this projected view of this person. The demons sit on the thrones of all of these universes, and they are the false idols that we think the world is governed by, but they are not. And that's why it's a universe, because we tend to think the more that we allow them to sit in this field inside of us, the more that it takes on a life of its own. It's like, oh man, my, you know, everything bad that's happened to me has brought tragedy upon me. I'm going to create a false idol that the whole world and that God has something against me because my siblings used to do this to me. And this was an example of how that happened. And so then I'm going to create an entire universe in which it feels like tragedy is attracted to me. Right. That's what, and so the feed your demon process is one of my favorites, simply because of the fact that the best way to deal with something that you feel is exceptionally powerful is to face it in a space of non-fear. When you face your demon and you feed it and you give it whatever it is that it wants, you are coming in a place of abundance, because you say, there is literally nothing you can take from me that I don't have in spades. So if you want me to perish, I'm going to do that because I can do that in my mental field. I can do that as I call the imaginary plane. I can do that inside of myself, and there's no harm. And I'm going to be disarming you because I'm going to give you exactly what you want. And then, you know, and so this is the process, is basically you identify the demon, you see them inside of yourself, you ask them, what is it that you want? Right. And oftentimes it could be something really harmful, right? And so you give them everything you want, and then you ask them, what is it that you need, right? And then that's usually something that's deeper. That's usually something like, I want to be loved, right? Or I want to be something like that. It's not always good. It can also be that both the questions kind of come into a negative aspect. And then once you literally drain yourself of all of those things to the point where I do it at this point, where I like come into a puddle on the floor, like I'm just completely giving everything away, knowing that I have an abundance of myself still left, even if I like get rid of that. And then what will happen is they consume it. Either they dissipate, or they become an ally, or they weaken. Right. Sometimes you have to do it multiple times. And you're going to talk about family constellation, right? In regards to this.
Yeah. So family constellation is kind of similar to feed your demon, in the sense that you're still working with the imaginary field, but it's done with a therapist trained in family constellation who works as a mediator. And I did this once, and it was really powerful work. It's probably what first helped shift my level 5 relationship with my sister to a level 4, if I'm kind of backtracking. And one of the things that the therapist does, they help you create in physical space a representation of your family with symbols. So for example, I think we used spool of threads. Like I used different spools of thread that represented different family members. So my mom was the bigger pink one, and my dad was a bigger black one, and my sister and I were different shapes and sizes of spools of thread. And then you put them on the table and you line them up in a way that energetically feels like what your family dynamic felt like when you were growing up. So for example, I put myself right next to my father, because my father kind of leaned into me a lot emotionally. He would ask me advice, like on how to raise my siblings, which in reflection was like putting me on an emotional level, like in a different place than them. And then my mom, who had died, energetically, I felt like she wasn't even part of the dynamic. So I had her like on the outskirts of the whole family, right? And then I had my sister all alone, because I felt like my sister was very isolated in childhood emotionally. And then my two brothers were off to the side together. So then the therapist helped me, through talking things out and through energy work, to move all the spools of thread back into the position that they was a harmonious position of how things should be, with mother and father on one side and the children on the other together. making like a cohesive family unit through symbols. And she said, basically what you're doing is you're creating an energetic pace, like pacing, meaning mirroring. So we set up the dynamic energetically how it is. And then very slowly we energetically and mentally shift the dynamic with symbolic representations to then create a blueprint for the universe and in your own mind, okay, which is the greatest creator of them all, to create a new family dynamic. And it sounds very esoteric, but it was very helpful. Like we cried, like it was very meaningful to move the pieces around. So you can find a family constellation therapist. They might do it differently now. It might've been just that therapist technique, but it was very useful.
Yeah. And I think it's incredibly useful because we've talked about this in the past and we're not necessarily bringing this up now, you know, in terms of dynamics of siblings, you know, it's a really, I feel like family constellation, being able to actually physically see it. You can see levels of triangulation and favoritism. And, you know, we've talked in the past about the golden child versus the scapegoat and like what it can feel like if a scapegoat is doing that dynamic, they're probably going to see maybe everybody on one side and them away from everybody, right? If they're the golden child, they may see themselves next to the parents. And it's a good, you know, it's a good opportunity, I feel like, in order to even the glass child, right? The glass child being the child who is born after or in relation to a child who has special needs. And, you know, you can see all these different dynamics going on and we have terminology for them. And those terminologies help us to understand these dynamics and it can help you to understand it. But it is also a very important first step to what is all this other bits and pieces in terms of like forgiving it and kind of recognizing that, like, you know, everyone's going to be doing the things that they're going to be doing for a very specific reason. And if we bring in the four agreements, which is Don Miguel Ruiz, which is don't make assumptions, don't take anything personally, be impeccable with your word, and always do your best. You can see that, you know, when you take that approach, that's kind of the approach that we're taking with all of this as we heal this. That was kind of a ton of information just chunk in there, but yeah.
Okay, moving into the third major way to heal a relationship, we're going to talk about the 360 degree life review. And I just want to point out the fact that of the five things we're talking about today, three can happen all on your own, all on your lonesome, without even calling your sibling, okay? Even seeing your sibling. So much of healing a relationship has to do with healing how you perceive the relationship, how you identify with the relationship, and so much is going to happen behind the scenes before you even interact with the sibling. Because I think a lot of people, when they hear, oh, marriage is a lot of work, what they don't understand is what they mean by that when they say marriage is a lot of work is that relationships are a lot of work. And a majority of the work is happening off screen. Okay. I just want to like put that little bit out there. So, okay. The 360 degree life review is a review which happens in a lot of people who have near-death experiences. If you go back and listen to the episode, which I'll put in the show notes, we talk about central themes that happen to people who survive near-death experiences that go on to see the light and this and that. And a big percentage of them come back saying that they experienced the 360 degree life review. So what is that? That is the life review where when you're in that death space, by the way, time does not exist the way it does here. So you can live a thousand years in like 2 minutes. Like you can be dead for a minute or be unconscious for 30 seconds and have yet experienced the whole life review. And so in that 360 life review, you basically go back and remember every event that happened to you, like every decision you made from birth until the present day, but not just that, but how it affected everyone around you. If you smiled at the cash register lady checking you out of the grocery store, you see how that smile went on to help her day. If you gave, you know, your change to the homeless guy, you see how that benefited him. If you spread a rumor about someone and really hurt them, you start to see that ramification. So you kind of get a global picture of how all the things you've done to others have affected them in like a whole domino effect. So it's not just what your life looked like, it's how your actions affected all the other people. And it's funny because sometimes when I've been mad at people, I'm like, damn it, I can't wait for their 360 degree life review and they're going to see what assholes they were to me. So the 360 degree life review was something that I think then moved my relationship with my sister from a level 4 to a level 3. And I did this with our shaman, Robbie, and I'll put her contact in here. But I was talking to her about how I desperately wanted to have a level 1. I wasn't calling it a level 1 then, relationship with my sister. And I didn't know how to go from there. And she had me close my eyes and go back in time and imagine my entire childhood. So like, just, you know, I don't know how long it took, but I kind of closed my eyes and I went through my entire childhood and, you know, all my interactions grossly, you know, my grossly interactions with my siblings, my families, my major memories, this and that, my interactions with my sister. And then she said, now I want you to close your eyes and I want you to go back and imagine what life was like for your sister. And I did the same thing. And I like came out of it crying. Because for the first time in my life, I finally understood why she thought I was such a brat. You know, like I finally understood why she didn't like me that much. And I finally understood from her perspective, whether or not it was true or false, just like mine was neither true nor false, it was hers. I could understand why she felt the way she felt about certain events that happened in our childhood and why she blamed me for a lot of things. So that was really, really, really helpful in helping me understand and generate a lot of empathy and compassion for her life. I think that's a really useful tool.
That is brilliant. That's and it makes a lot of sense too. I think it's a useful thing. It's Sufic wisdom to say die before you die, right? It's a beautiful saying, and it's something that I encourage a lot in the people that I work with, and I encourage in myself. It's just this understanding of like, die before you die, like keep that understanding. It's kind of like that song Galileo by Indigo Girls, like, you know, talking about reincarnation, like what did you do for yourself? You know, what did you do for your future self? There's so many different ways that you can view it, but that's a beautiful one. Thank you, Anna. So the next one is conversation. And this is, as Anna mentioned, the first three are all about what you can do in your own space to dissolve your projections, to help gain empathy for their position, especially if there's a dynamic like a golden child or a scapegoat going on, something along those lines. It's really, really important to gain empathy for the other person if you're wanting to move from a 5 or a 4 down. And it's also really important to dissolve whatever projections you have so that they can just show up as whoever they are. But there will come times when you actually just need to have a conversation and actually create a space of harmony between you and a sibling. And, you know, it could be that perhaps you have aging parents and you need to suddenly, you know, effectively come into some sort of agreement about what is going to happen between all these aging parents. I have a friend who works in the wealth and investment industry, and he works a lot with individuals who are having trouble with inheritance issues because of the fact that it is, I mean, just talk about bringing stress back into a situation. You could have been in a disharmonious family relationship with your siblings and then gone your own distance and gone your own way. And then suddenly your parents become aging or one of them dies, and suddenly you are thrust directly back into those dynamics yet again, right? And so the need to be able to have the tools to be able to reach into yourself and be able to say like, hey, this is how I'm actually going to have this conversation with this person who I am incredibly triggered by or I'm having difficulty with is really important. And so before I kind of get into the stress response, I want to say something that I've discovered and I work a lot with people on is this understanding that, you know, we've talked about birth order in the past, but, you know, birth order being in the episode about siblings a couple times ago, we talked about birth order. And one of the things that I have found, which is so interesting is, and this is something that I found in my own sibling conflict, was that there is so much transference that happens, especially with aging parents, but so much transference that happens between siblings when they cannot express a level of harmony and honesty with the parents. Right? So because you see your parents as old and decrepit, or because you see them as emotionally shut off, you have all of these feelings towards your parents, and yet you're transferring them over to your siblings. So Anna mentioned on the sibling episode that we are 70% raised by our older siblings, right? Which is a crazy stat, because don't your parents raise you? But we start to recognize that there is a dynamic that goes on in which the eldest sibling will often have the younger siblings transfer their pain that they have towards their parents to the older sibling. because the older sibling is younger, more agile, maybe they're more empathetic. You see them as more of a safe haven for your anger towards your parents, especially if you have aging and elderly and sick parents. You are going to, you may not have ever had a chance to create a level of level one harmony or even level four or level three harmony with your parents. And you are then transferring that to your oldest siblings or any of your older siblings. So if you're the youngest and you have a number of older siblings, you may see your second oldest sister as your mother. You may see your eldest as your father. And you are dealing with not just the stuff that happens between siblings, but you're pulling what's happening to the parents onto those older siblings. And one of the most crucial things that is necessary is to separate those two things, right? Recognize that your sibling, even if they were an older sibling, your sibling was doing the best that they could with the circumstances that they had. They were doing whatever they could, and they were coping in the way that they learned how to cope with their specific circumstances. They may not have protected you in the way that you wanted to if you were a younger sibling, right? But really, is it their responsible? Are they responsible for protecting you? Or is that actually the role of your parents and they didn't do it, right? That one parent didn't do it or the other one didn't do it. So the first thing to do, I feel like, or this is probably in addition to the things above, is to recognize that there is an absolute need to separate what is your sibling's responsibility from what it was your parents' responsibility, right? And separate those two things. That will make going into this conversation much, much simpler, right? Because then you start to recognize that. Also recognize that older siblings are going to be angry at their parents that they had to raise you. Right. And so they're going to be pissed off if you come to them acting like they are your parent, like they're your parent. That's exactly what happened with my sister and I. Right. I was feeling so much anger at my parents and I was lumping them all together. And she was pissed off because she was like, this has happened the whole time. You've never stopped doing this. You've never stopped seeing me as a parent. I don't want to be a parent. I just want to be your sibling. Right. And so older siblings can feel a lot of anger when they are sensing that same dynamic, that they are being treated and lumped into the same category as the parents. They're exceptionally sensitive to it. Right. And so it's very, very important to separate these things out in specifically with sibling relationships. And so having done that, you know, recognize that you may be feeling a massive amount of, this is about stress responses when it comes to coming into a conversation with somebody. If you are preparing to have a conversation and you're feeling that demon coming up, you're feeling and you're anticipating all the conversations that are going to happen, you're having a really difficult time with it, you are in an experience where you are unable to separate parent from sibling, or you're unable to separate the experience of having been parentified by your younger siblings. If you are doing any of those things, I would really recommend either you go back to the beginning and do more work with a therapist or something like or a mediator. Because if you are so stressed out about this and you're creating all these things and all of the previous steps didn't really work, or the previous things, I would really recommend that you get support with these conversations and recognize that it is worth it to get support, because ultimately our siblings, just like our family, but our siblings more so than anything, are literally trained to find our triggers. We do it for fun when we're younger, right? I mean, like we're literally, I mean, some people do it for fun. Some people do it to niggle or to make fun of their siblings, right? They know exactly your weakest spots. And as a result of that, you need to make sure that you are coming in there with the best strength that you possibly can, and that you are not afraid of your own triggers. You are not afraid of how you're going to respond during those triggers. You're not afraid of what it's going to feel like when you have those triggers. And if you're somebody like me who's avoidant, you need to disarm your triggers and you need to deal with that in a safe space as much as you possibly can before you go into a conversation. And you're also, you know, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I just want to ask, what do you mean by diffuse your triggers? Like I can just imagine someone listening and being like, well, what do you mean diffuse my triggers? How do I do that?
Right. So I fundamentally believe that all of us are completely responsible for our triggers, even if they were created by somebody else, because they're called triggers for a reason. You're holding the gun. Right? You are the one who is holding the gun And it's a trigger because you are going to react very strongly to it. So when I say you need to disarm your trigger, like you're literally needing to disarm the experience that you have of yourself. I explained this in depth when we talked about the episode in which Anna and I talked about coming together. I talked about a method for disarming a trigger. For me, I recognized that a lot of my trigger was the experience of being afraid of myself when I was triggered, right? Of the experience of being afraid of what was going to happen if I was going to get yelled at. The experience of getting afraid of all of those things. So much of that was just the energy that was surrounding the actual trigger itself. Doing it in a mediation made it feel like I was actually in a safe space where we weren't even going to go close to triggers. So here's a summary of disarming your triggers. The first thing is to recognize that you are the one who are, you're the one, these things exist within you. They are minds that have been set in your own mind field. They sit in your energy system. So going into them, dealing with them with a therapist, dealing with them in any of these other ways, Ho'oponopono, feed your deeming to all of these is going to help release that. Because in many ways, you can almost see a trigger as something that is an extension of a demon. The second is that you are dealing with the experience around a trigger. You may not even be worried about being triggered. You're just in that experience of that frenzy and that stress response is happening to you. So looking at that may be an example. The third is going straight to the mediation step in which you feel like you can be, there's a third party who you can trust who's going to be able to, and we'll talk about this more in a minute, in a second, you in which you feel like there are ground rules, right? And that there are actual ways of doing this. So like Anna, for instance, Anna and I had a mediator, we set ground rules for those conversations and we continued those ground rules. Now we know those ground rules, right? So I feel much more strong about this, that we're able to handle whatever triggers come up for us because we have an understanding of what those ground rules need to look like. Most of us don't even bother to do that work with another person, right? Because it just never gets to that conversation. Does that make sense? And so, you know, one of the things that I feel like this maybe belongs in the mediation category is that when, but you can do it in a conversation as well, is recognizing that there are a couple of techniques that we've talked about in the past. Like for instance, sandwiching is a really great example of a technique that you can have in a conversation, right? And we could go into detail. We could probably talk for another hour about, you know, all of the things that you can do, but recognize that you know the other person's trigger as much as they know yours. You also probably know their glimmers, which is Jay Field's terminology for the opposite of a trigger. What can you do in that conversation to offer a glimmer to the other person, right? And maybe it feels like you need to be the bigger person, but aren't we all just trying to be the bigger person? And so that's kind of some of the things around conversation is this idea that, you know, you may be bringing up a lot of old stress response cycles when you start to talk to somebody. Hopefully you've done a lot to realize those and have those come out. Hopefully you've done something to deal with the triggers. And hopefully you're to the point where you can offer a glimmer. And if not, I would really recommend that maybe go to mediation. Anna, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I totally agree. And I think, you know, reflecting on if, for example, your primal moon is rejection and you know that you're a fleer, try to stay present, try to be present, you know, try to do the exact opposite thing that your mask would have you do. Like me, mine is to attack, you know, verbally or whatever. The opposite would be to not attack and to just take it in, right? And not counter everything the person says and be silent. Actually, silence would be a huge opposite for me. So like try to figure out what your go-to stress response is and try practicing doing the exact opposite thing. Cause even if it's right or wrong, it'll just at least get you out of the same habit, which clearly isn't working if you're in a level 4 or 5, right?
Right. So to give a summary of that, it would be if you have an injustice wound and you have a tendency to be extremely rigid and principled about whatever it is you're doing, you're allowing yourself to be more flexible, let in other opinions and principles, and recognize mm-hmm. that maybe your opinion or your view of things is not the only view.
Right.
If you go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, and check yourself for things like size and eye rolling and, you know, kind of like discuss that you would actually believe this, like a nonverbal communication? Because I know people with an injustice wound, they're like, how could you even vote for that person? Like, are you an idiot? You know, like there's a lot of disdain for, there's disdain for a difference of opinion. If I want to,
exactly.
I see that with injustice people.
Exactly. If you were a rejection wound person, and I can say this from very distinct experience, recognize that you may have an incredibly strong stress response cycle and you may get incredibly dysregulated just at the thought of having the conversation. You may be the type of person who has the argument in your head, but never has it in person. Right. And so recognize that you are needing to approach this conversation with curiosity, because I think that curiosity is something that Anna taught me in our disagreement, was that my typical response was just to go on the defensive and then to just kind of want to not engage at all. And yet if I could be curious about the other person, if they were willing to keep the same ground rules, that the curiosity is my way of leaning in. You may have a different way of leaning in. Maybe your way is, you know, trying to, you know, I don't know, what would be another way of leaning into a conversation when you're typically a fugitive besides curiosity?
I know this sounds silly, but maybe count their eyelid, their blinks, like, mm-hmm. like, find something to distract you, but to make you present. Like, for example, in this one of the books that I listened to on the pearls, it was talking about how eye contact is really important in relationships, and that by just counting how many times someone blinks in an hour or 10 minutes or whatever can help you facilitate eye contact. And I know this is a really far stretch, but maybe if your go-to is rejection, you start counting eye blinks because it makes you be present in the moment and actually engage with the other person.
And look in their eyes, as hard as that is, right? Which can be hard.
Right? That could be one. I don't know. Am I crazy?
No, I like that. No, I really like that, because I think that it basically, it kind of makes it so that you're there. Also, again, I would recommend rejection wound people probably go to a mediator who's going to put you in a super safe space so that you can feel that way. The betrayal, know that your mask is to control, and therefore your job is to not try and control the flow of the conversation.
Right. And another thing is if yours is betrayal, you really should have the conversation in person, because I think betrayal people in an attempt to control are very quick to hang up the phone or to block the other person, or just decide when the conversation ends. That's a betrayal control thing, right?
Yes. Yes, exactly. So giving yourself that full space, which I feel like this one, the 5-minute conversation is a great one, possibly for betrayal wound people, because you're forcing people to be time boxed and you're not allowed to leave. And then abandonment people, I would say, if going with the fact that I don't know if the codependent necessarily goes directly towards anger, but given that as an example, would you say that?
I think that with abandonment, there's two sides of this one. There's either the people pleasing one, which is like, well, I just don't want to fight, so I'm just going to agree with you that everything was my fault and let's just move on from here. Yeah. Yes. 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 You're right. Yes. I'm so sorry I did that. How can I make it up to you? There's that side of it. But then when abandonment wounded people have done that so much and they're basically like at the end of the rope with that, they get to the point where they feel extremely angry and they're like, I have done so much for you. Why can't you do this for me? Why are you leaving me when I have done everything in my power to keep you? And that, so I think that abandonment wound can have like, in the early stages of it is the people pleasing, and in the I'm totally dysregulated state, it's anger.
Yeah. And so in which case then your job is just to be present and silent, to Anna's point, because I think that addresses both of them. If you are trying to placate somebody and get them to be quiet and just agree, like you are being just as, you're bringing up your wound just as much in that conversation as you would otherwise. And then with humiliation, it's the masochist, right? So this is another example of being, we used to call it the perpetrator fallacy. And it was like your go-to mask is masochism, which means somebody, you're addressing a conversation and instead of agreeing with the person, you're taking all the blame, right? You're taking all the responsibility. That would be your go-to in that situation. Your job is to probably, again, stay silent, allow the other person to talk, and recognize that almost none of this is personal, which is one of the reasons why I think Don Miguel Ruiz came in. None of this is personal. And your job is not to short circuit the conversation by taking all the blame, right? Because blame is just, blame is a tool of the drama triangle, 100%. And so if you're wanting to move your relationship out of a level five or any of those higher levels, which are very drama triangle related, you need to use a different tool, which is, I'm just going to be quiet. I'm just going to listen to this. And maybe nobody has to take the blame for this.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I think with humiliation, similarly to abandonment, there could be two sides. I think that they can either be self-humiliating, self-deprecating. Oh my gosh, I'm such at fault here. Or they can take the other side and shame the other. Because I know of someone who has a very strong humiliation wound, and in an argument, they basically like broke me down in every which way, shaming me, right? If that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. I think you're right. I think that it can either be self or other inflicted, right? And in this case, your job is not to, you're basically, your job with the humiliation wound is not to use the tools of shame and blame, which are 100% the tools of the drama triangle. So yeah.
So then the next thing I want to talk about, I think this tool also came from Robbie. I just can't remember who taught me this tool, but I did this with my sister. This moved us from a 3 to a 2, maybe even a 1. I'm not sure, but this was like transformational. Is we had a conversation, and basically how it started was either I or she reached out to each other and we said, look, the relationship is just not where we want it to be. Can we have a conversation? But before we do that, let's open the air and let's have a conversation where we agree to the following. And what we agreed to was that we were going to have a timer and it was going to be 5 minutes on and then 5 minutes the other person. And the rules were you were not allowed to hang up on the person and you were not allowed to interrupt the person. So I had 5 minutes to say everything I wanted to say. And then she had 5 minutes to say everything she wanted to say. And, you know, that was really hard because you're like, but that's not true, but this is my take on it, but and went back and forth, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes, 5 minutes. And it was my turn. I was able to defend myself. And when it was her 5 minutes, she was able to defend herself. And by the time we got to the end of it, I don't know how many exchanges of that was, maybe an hour's worth. I don't know. When we got to the last 5 minutes, we were actually spending our 5 minutes apologizing and understanding that we saw things finally from each other's point of view and how sorry we were, and that we just really want to work towards making the relationship better. That was really helpful for us. Both of us have had, you know, a lot of experience with this kind of stuff. So we were able to do it. And that's why we're going to talk about, if you don't feel comfortable doing that, there's no shame in getting a mediator. We're going to talk about that step next. But yeah, there is that thing that you could do, was the 5 minute thing.
Yeah. And for me as a rejection wound person, it terrifies me to even think about doing that even now. Which is why I'm just like, if you have a rejection wound, I would recommend going into that safe space. But then at the same time, there are some people who I don't express my rejection wound with, like my partner. And I feel like I could do it with, I could feel like I could do that with my partner, and I would feel totally comfortable and safe doing that with my partner. Right. Mm-hmm. And so you just start, I mean, we don't even need to get into how sometimes some wounds show up with some people and not with others.
Right. Then the other thing I want to talk about is beyond having the conversation, you know, like, hey, let's make this relationship work. What can we do? And all that. I want to talk about something called BIDS. So if you remember a long time ago, we talked about this book by John Gottman, PhD, The 7 Principles for Making a Marriage Work. Well, there's a new book that has come out. It's called The Relationship Cure, a 5-step guide to strengthening your marriage, family, and friendships. And he talks in this book a lot about BIDS. And I really like this because I didn't have a term for it before, but it'll be like, my husband will try to start a conversation about something that is like totally pointless or boring to me. And I'm like, why is he asking me that dumb question? He could just Google it. And I would be like, I would say sometimes like, hey, babe, you know, there is Google, there is Alexa. And he'd say, I'm just trying to connect with you. Is there something wrong with wanting to connect with my wife? And then I would be like, God, I'm a fucking asshole. So I have a term for this now. He was making a bid and I had a choice to turn towards, turn against, or turn away. And what I would do was turn away. I'd be like, go ask Google, go ask Alexa. But I'm going to be more cognizant of this now going forward. So John Gottman says, even our best efforts to connect can be jeopardized as a result of one basic problem, failure to master what I call the BID, the fundamental unit of emotional communication. The best way to communicate and connect emotionally with others is by bidding and responding to their bids. This could be a gesture, a look, a request, some sort of willingness to communicate. Hey, let's watch that show together. Hey, you want to go grocery shopping with me? Like my sister always asks me to do that. And I love to go. It's part of human nature to want to feel connected and to make a bid and to respond to the bid. And there are three ways with which we respond to bids. And so our siblings will make bids to us, right? The three ways are turning towards. This is when you react positively with them so that the other party feels connected. Turning against means using sarcasm or ridicule to turn against them. This is not recommended because it can hurt feelings. And turning away. This involves deliberately ignoring the bid of the other or acting preoccupied. When this happens, the other party can become emotionally drained and it takes a toll on the relationship. I remember one time a friend told me that if someone invites you to something and you don't want to go, you should go one in two or three times that they ask you, because they're eventually going to stop asking you otherwise. Yeah. And I thought that was really interesting because she had a very full social calendar. And I realized a lot of things she was doing was she was responding to bids. So she would get more bids.
Yeah.
And I think it's really interesting. I'm not saying live your life for others, but I am saying, like, if someone is trying to connect with you and reach out, if you turn towards them and you're constantly turning away, they're going to eventually stop turning towards you and making a bid. So anyways, the six major barriers to bidding effectively and responding positively to the bids for others are these. Number one, being unaware of the needs of others. Two, starting conversations on a sour note. Three, communicating harmful criticisms instead of helpful complaints. Number four, letting yourself be triggered by negative emotions during conflicts. Five, constantly feeling irritable about people and places. Six, avoiding those conversations you need to have. So that is kind of in line with the conversation. Maybe start to be aware of what kind of bids are your siblings putting out. Maybe it's a meme. Maybe they send you a funny meme and they just want you to say, ha ha, right back, or maybe send them a meme back, you know, but there's ways that you can respond to bids. The next thing we're going to talk about is mediation. So Christine and I talked about this in our Getting Together Again episode. After we had a major argument, we did hire an expert, Paul Lewis. We'll put him in the notes. I think Robbie Howcheck would also be a great mediator if she has room in her calendar, but, or a therapist. But if you are going to do mediation, it's really important that you pick a non-biased therapist. And I recommend going to a neutral party that has never worked with either of you before, because I've heard it from Christina. I've heard it from friends doing marriage counseling. It sucks to walk into a room and you feel that there's a bias because that therapist has been working with the other person longer. And they have their own perceptions and idolatry of you, right? So there's that. There's no shame in hiring a mediator. We are on this earth for such a very short time until we get to come back. Where's the harm in hiring help if our relationships are really what we're going to think about when we die? When we die, we have that 360 life review. Like, what's more important than the relationships we make and foster in this lifetime? So I wanted to talk about that. And then Christina was going to talk about the bridge of intimacy.
Yeah. So I've used this analogy and I've developed it a lot since we first talked about it way back at the end of season three, something along those lines, when we talked about intimacy. And it's a basic kind of, in some ways you could almost use it to summarize what we're talking about with the different levels and things like that. As children growing up with siblings, we build bridges. Sometimes we build destructive bridges that are not built on trust, but they're just built on regionality and access. And those are usually made out of straw. Like, they're never going to last past everybody leaving and like, I'm just never going to talk to you again. But a lot of the time we are building with these bids, with everything else, we build bridges with another person. We're often building them with trust, blocks of trust. Right? So something good happened. We're going to do this. I trust you. I do this. Like, we're blood. These are our principles. All these different things allow us to build these bridges between one another. And we talked about this in relation to codependence and counterdependence, and how codependent people have a tendency to want to build the other person's bridge, the other person's side of the bridge. Whereas the counterdependent is going to be totally fine with a codependent building their side of the bridge. right? The idea is that once the bridge gets built, intimacy moves between them. And what I mean by intimacy is it could be physical, it could be emotional, it could be, you know, it's somebody that you're allowing into an inner circle or an inner part or an inner truth of yourself, right? And you've built this bridge for long enough that you can have all these different lanes of intimacy with siblings. Obviously, you probably wouldn't have a physical or a sexual intimacy. That would not be okay. But, you know, you would have an emotional or a mental intimacy with them that would make it so that things can move across, right? And if you are in a wonderful place with your sibling, you may talk to your sibling every single day, and there's a lot of traffic going across that bridge, right? And you're like, this is fantastic. What you may start to recognize is that you may have an old and decrepit bridge, which you feel like should be totally condemned, right? Because you're just like, no traffic has gone across this bridge. We haven't built this trust. We haven't done anything. And so therefore I have no desire to have any intimacy with this person. But what we also start to recognize is that sometimes we build lanes of in which, again, because we have trust with that person that they're going to still be there, we send traffic over that is intentionally maybe us just trying to get something off of our chest, but it's not necessarily there. Maybe we're feeling frustrated in another part of our life and we can't express it. And we start sending barbs and we start sending, you know, nasty things across this bridge, right? And with everybody, we need to recognize this. I mean, it's why people say that, you know, the worst people, the people who you treat the worst are the people who are closest to you. That's an example of what I'm talking about here. Whereas you don't feel comfortable expressing yourself in any other way. So you use your tried and true bridges that you already have to send your anger across on, or to send your, you know, your worry across on, right? And so you're just using these bridges, you're kind of abusing these bridges because they're intimacy. You know, the person's going to sit there and listen to you. You know that they're going to bother to actually like be sitting on the other side of it. But what you start to recognize is that the more you send this across and the more they send this across, the bridge starts to dissolve. The trust gets lost, especially if your partner knows that you're throwing anger at them, getting angry and mad at something that they've done, or your sibling is, and you're like, but I recognize this isn't about me, right? And ultimately that's what we start to, you know, you're never upset for the reason you think, right? Recognize that everybody has a responsibility to not send their anger across on their bridges of intimacy, right? That's like one responsibility. A mediator, I feel like, is perfectly positioned in many ways. And I feel like this is the thing that I really appreciated about Paul, because of the fact that I was a rejection wound person. All he did was remind us of the bridge. That's literally what he did. All he did was he said, remind me of the bridge, guys. Tell me about the bridge. What is the bridge? What is the bridge that sits between you? He was always, always, always. And so for us, we perceived it as maybe being slow, but he didn't allow any of the traffic that's been moving across for months and months and months, or the lack of traffic that had been moving for lack of, you know, for months and months and months. All he said was, remember the bridge, guys.
Well, I think he was also like the guy who stands there with the hand, stop, and then let the traffic through. He'd be like, stop, ground yourself, let the traffic through.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so I just see it as like, we're all just like Venice, and we have all these bridges to all these different people and places and companies and everything like that. And we have, you know, and trust builds those bridges. And the longer that they're around, the more trust that we build with somebody, the stronger the bridge is, the more it can handle. But we have to be cognizant of what we're sending across the bridge. And the mediator can help us with what we're sending across the bridge. You have a choice of what you send across the bridge.
Yeah. Don't think of it like, oh, I need a shrink. Think of it like, I need just a traffic controller.
Exactly. Who's going to be like, you are going too fast.
Yeah.
Sorry. You're driving aggressively. No.
You need to slow down there. Put on the brakes. Just put on the brakes.
Exactly.
Here is the bridge and put on the brakes.
Exactly.
Yes. Well, this was probably one of our longest episodes. We hope you like it. We love your feedback. Send us an email at this.spiritual.fix@gmail.com. We'd love to hear some success stories of you shifting a relationship from a level 5 to a 4. Wherever you are in your relationship challenges, we're wishing you the best.
Yes, and thank you to our people who wrote in. Jenny, thank you for that. I heard from Janet. I heard from a lot of wonderful people in our email. We love receiving them. So thank you so much for your input. They all came into what we were talking about today.
Yeah, and thank you to my siblings. If you ever listen, I adore you.
Bye. And I love my sibling too. I gotta add that.
You gotta add it. Bye. All right,
bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of This Spiritual Fix. If you have any feedback, we would love to hear it. this.spiritual.fix@gmail.com. Thanks, y'all.
And remember,
humility, gratitude, acceptance, done.
Thank you for listening, TSF family, to our podcast. And I wanted to let you know, as Christina, that I have launched my new meditation store at www.playconscious.com. That's PlayConscious.com, where you can get all of my meditations, and it will also be the future home of the digitized versions of the TSF store. Thank you so much for your time and your support. And don't forget to use your TSF family code for an additional 20% off.